please.
It's not quite what I put on there, is it? But desired evidence for creation is, I wasn't listening when I told you what the subject was. Design and evidence for creation. One of the things that I come up against when I tell somebody that I believe in God is people say, well, surely science has proved that there's no need for a God. And I, in absolute honesty, would say the complete opposite. What I see in creation, in particular, in two particular fields, one is the cosmos and the universe, and the fact that the whole of the universe that we look at is ruled by certain laws, and there's certain constants and things like that that are set right from the beginning and have to be just right, on the one hand, and on the other hand it's the detail and the exquisite detail of life, on the other hand, that convince me that there is a God. And not only that there is a God, but there is only one God and one supreme God. And that God corresponds to the God of the Bible. And it's not our subject tonight, but the reason for the God of the Bible, of course, is the fact that the Bible is full of prophecy. And prophecy is the only book and the only scripture, if you like, that is full of prophecy and has those credentials to show that it is a book written by God. And so that's why it's the Bible, and why the evidence of the gospel is what I take as the God who created things. But tonight what I want to look at really is one aspect of that, and that is life and designing creation. And in one sense it's a fairly old argument, but in another sense recently, particularly with the advent of certain things like intelligent design as a theory, it's something that's come to the fore once more. And it's actually an incredibly powerful argument for God when we see it. So hopefully I'll be able to get that across to you tonight. So we're going to look at, first of all, just a summary of what we're going to look at. First of all, we want to look at what the Bible says about design in particular and about creation. Then the other side of the story, what evolutionists say and what their argument is. And then we're going to have a look at the argument for design, which is a fairly old argument. We're going to then look at intelligent design, which is an update really of the argument for design, and we'll see why that is, and then some specific parts of that. One of them is one of the arguments. It sounds very technical, but it isn't really. It's kind of a formulation of common sense really. One is specified complexity and the other is irreducible complexity. There are other branches of this idea of intelligent design, but they're the main ones. Then we're going to look at an example, because examples are always better than theory, and that example is, and I love the name, the bacterial flagellum, and you'll see why it's called that. It sounds very Roman, that, doesn't it? But it's and then we're going to summarize at the end, just go back to the Bible and kind of summarize what we've seen, and kind of leave you with a challenge really. So, first of all, what the Bible says. What does the Bible say? Well, I've picked out three passages just to illustrate the point. Two from the Old Testament and one from the New. And we'll come back to these at the end. The first is a bit uncompromising. And it's God's assessment of an atheist, really. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And it's a whole psalm. In fact, two psalms, which are almost identical, start with these words, Psalm 14 and Psalm 53. We don't need to read it all out, but it's pretty uncompromising, that, isn't it? That as far as God's concerned, if you look around in creation and say there's no God, you're a fool. Which, well, that's the Bible, what the Bible says. Here's the other side of the coin. This is David speaking, and he says, part of the psalm, which at the end we'll look at a bit more, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvellous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. So here's the other side of the coin. Here's somebody who looks at creation, looks at themselves, and says, it's incredible what God has done. And looks a bit like that hymn that we sang, isn't it? But it's incredible that he looks around and he sees what an amazing creation God has created, and I'm part of that, and he's just overwhelmed by it. So there's the two sides, really, that the Bible gives. And obviously the Bible is saying, you know, look, it's obvious, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. What about in the New Testament? Well, in the New Testament quotation, again, we'll look at this more deeply later on, or more closely, is in Romans chapter 1. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, his eternal power and Godhead, so that men are without excuse. So in a way, this passage in the New Testament brings those other two passages together, doesn't it? On the one hand, it's saying, you look at creation and it's obvious it was made by God, and you've got no excuse if you say otherwise. So on the one hand, it's I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, and on the other hand, the fool has said in his heart there is no God, and it's brought together in this passage, and we'll look at that again later. So the Bible's very clear, not only that it's obvious that looking at creation tells us that there is a God, but that we ought to, if we look at creation around us, it ought to tell us that there is a God, and it ought not to tell us otherwise. It's obvious, as far as the Bible's concerned, that creation teaches us that there is a God. And I tend to agree with that. And of what I've seen, to me, it's obvious. Excuse me. So what about the other side of the coin then? What about, what do the evolutionists say? And in particular, I suppose, the atheist evolutionists say about the world around us. Well, so they also have a list of things, and they look around and they see the world and they say it's a naturalistic world, a world that occurred by itself. They don't see God in it at all. In fact, the world that they see, evolution as a process to produce this world, then removes the need for God. There are some people who believe in God and also believe in evolution. I'm not quite sure why they do that. Maybe it's a compromise, I don't know, but I just don't see it. It's also a materialistic sense. In one sense, you could think of it as an excuse for materialism, but it's also materialistic in the sense that there is no creator. It's just the materials of the universe and the world went towards creating life, or, well, evolving life, not creating. It totally denies the miraculous, which is the opposite of the Bible, isn't it? The Bible tells us that Jesus rose from the dead. The Bible tells us that Jesus performed various miracles, and others also. So it denies anything like that as well. That's not possible. And also denies a supernatural cause. There is no God, in other words. Nothing crazy. It just happened. It was a chance event that life is here. There's no reason why we're here. We're just here because, well, we're lucky. And that's it. It's blind. What do I mean by that? Well, it has, well, the next one on the line is without purpose. That's the same thing as blind. It doesn't, there's no end result, a goal to be aimed for through evolution. It's just blind. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. If it happened again, maybe a totally different result would occur. So it doesn't have goals and seek anything. It's without purpose. It's without meaning as well. There's no meaning in the world if you believe in evolution and there is no God. There's no reason to be here. You might as well do whatever you like. There's no purpose in life. It's selfish. In one sense, it's selfish in the sense of survival of the fittest. I suppose evolutionists would argue, well, sometimes it suits survival to work together, so in that sense it's not selfish. But in a general sense, it is a fairly selfish thing, and it certainly gets rid of the need for any God to worship and to live up to God's commands, which teaches how to behave better than human nature does. And last of all, and probably most importantly, it's hopeless. There's no hope. If you believe in evolution and there's no God and there's no meaning in life, then when you die, you die. That's it. Gone. There's nothing left. And that's the truth of it. Now, don't take my words for it. Richard Dawkins is quite well known as somebody who advocates evolution in the terms of, you know, a very strong atheist as well. And this is what he says in his book, in the first few pages of his book, The Blind Watchmaker. All appearances to the contrary, the only watchmaker in nature is blind forces of physics, albeit deployed in a very special way. A true watchmaker has foresight. He designs his cogs and springs and plans their interconnections with a future purpose in his mind's eye. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process, which Darwin discovered and which we now know is the explanation for the existence and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind and no mind's eye. It does not plan for the future. It has no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of a watchmaker in nature, it is a blind watchmaker. So, as far as he's concerned, we're just a lucky accident, and that's why we're here. And there's no purpose to life whatsoever. We just might as well make the most of it. And that's the end of it, as far as he's concerned. Here's another quotation, again from Richard Dawkins, which I find very illuminating. He says, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose." Now, to me, if it's an appearance, then it's probably true, but hey, that's his statement. And I think it's in the same book as well, if I remember rightly. Another one, Francis Crick, he discovered the double helix nature of DNA. "Biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved." Why must they do that? Well, because it looks like it's been designed. And I think that's very significant, as we'll come to later, that actually it's very difficult, and you'll notice it when you watch a nature program on TV where they're trying to advocate evolution, but they can't help saying it was designed to do this or it was designed to do that. So it makes it very difficult for somebody who is trying to advocate evolution, that really, really does look like it's been designed when we look at the world around us. And there you go, there's an example, that picture there. Taken down in Dorset was a picture of I don't think it is actually a dragonfly, I think it's something else, but you can see the intricate detail in that. It looks designed to me. You know, it's just kind of obvious when you look at it, but apparently for some it's evolved. So what is the process of evolution? Well, the process as far as evolution is concerned, and certainly as far as the likes of Richard Dawkins and so on are concerned, is twofold really, and it's quite a negative thing really. Natural selection is not a positive thing. The engine, if you like, of evolution, and this does happen, but on a very small scale, which is why you get certain bugs that become able to overcome antibiotics and things like that, because on a small scale this does actually happen, and that is that you get mutations, random mutations within the gene, and if it has some kind of advantage, then the sieve of natural selection will let it through, because the generations can go on and they have an advantage and they're able to reproduce. Detrimental effects, which are by far in the majority, they're thrown out by the same process. So it's a bit like a sieve or a filter that it goes through, this filter of natural selection. But natural selection really just gets rid of the rubbish, and the random mutations maybe push the odd thing is advantageous. In general, mutations are not strictly advantageous, but get around the problem. They also cause other problems, and by far the majority of mutations are bad mutations, which are detrimental effects. So that just gives you a feel for what evolution is. Just to give you an idea of numbers, if you like, this is the combinations of a Rubik's Cube. You've got to get the colours the same on a nine-sided face and the six faces. 43.25 billion to one chances. So the combinations are just on that, there's 43.25 billion different combinations on a Rubik's Cube, and only one is right. So it gives you an idea of numbers. That's just a Rubik's Cube. That's not, you know, kind of the detail of life that we'll come to in a little bit. So you can see how the numbers have to be absolutely enormous before you get any change. And of course, with microbes and things that overcome penicillin, the numbers are enormous because there's so many of them. When it comes to mammals and things like that, you know, there's not as many of us, so mutations are a lot slower. So the argument for design, this is the argument, it's an old argument we're going to look at, and there's two sides to it. One of them is a 200-year-old argument now, which is William Paley, and he gave his argument for the watch, we'll look at in a minute. Darwin himself wrote about something in The Origin of Species about the human eye, and then in detail we'll look at this relatively new thing of intelligent design to see what that's all about, so you can see, because often it's just stated that intelligent design is bad science and just ignore it. Well, there's a reason for wanting you not to look at it in a way, as far as I can see, because it does make a lot of sense. A lot of common sense as well. Well, this was William Paley's argument from 200 years ago, and I think natural theology. That's the word I'm looking for. Natural theology, to say you look around you and you see. And his argument was, well, suppose I was crossing a heath and I knocked my foot, pitched my foot against a stone. What would I say? Well, I'd say, well, maybe that stone's been there forever, for all I know. You know, you wouldn't think twice, would you, about a stone? But suppose it was a watch. Suppose I knocked my foot against the watch and looked down. You wouldn't say the same thing, would you? You wouldn't say, oh, it's been there forever, I'll just ignore that. You would automatically think, oh, wait, who's dropped that? Is probably what you'd really think. Who's lost that watch? And then you open it up and look inside and you see that there must have existed at some point, you know, somebody who made that watch, or several people who made that watch. It has a purpose, there's a reason for it being made, and you open up and say, there's the cogs and the detail of what it does, and it's obviously been designed, there's no doubt about that, and common sense would tell you that. And he was saying, well, you do that, and then you look at nature around you, and you look at how the body works, and how all sorts of different parts of life work, and you think, well, that's the same. It's got a purpose and a reason for being there, and it works together, and it's obviously been designed, more so than the watch that you find on the floor. And that was his argument. Now, that argument was argued against, particularly at that time. Bearing in mind, people didn't know the detail that we know now of the detail of life and of the cell. They thought cell was just a little jelly thing, a little tiny jelly thing, and that was it. Now we know a lot different. They thought life just happened spontaneously. Charles Darwin thought that until Louis Pasteur came along and proved otherwise, that life isn't spontaneous. And so that, you know, those kind of thoughts affected the way people would argue against this. And one of the main arguments that was kind of successful at the time was the argument that it's too much of an analogy. It's not the same thing. It's an analogy for it, and you can't put the two together. And philosophically, that argument held sway, and maybe people wanted that argument to hold sway. What about the eye? This was Charles Darwin's. Always makes me jump when I look at that. I don't know how you, but it did me. Charles Darwin made this point in his book, The Origin of Species. He says, to suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection, seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. And I tend to agree with him with that. I mean, that, you know, he was being honest there. You've got to give him that. He was being honest. But to me, that's pretty obvious as well. Especially when you consider that the eye in different species, according to evolutionists, had to have evolved separately at least 40 times. And that's not what I say, that's what evolutionists say. and to expect, and in some cases they're almost identical, those eyes that have suggested that they've evolved. Now, that sounds pretty amazing to me, and unlikely for something that is totally random in the way that it works. You wouldn't expect that kind of thing to happen. That's not what evolution predicts. That's what creation predicts, that you would have, you know, different species that have eyes built by the same creator, not what evolution would predict. So I think he's right. He's got a good point. And there's just a diagram, if you like, of how the eye works. I won't be asking questions afterwards, so you don't need to look too closely. But you get the point, don't you? It's not a simple thing. It's a very well put together and engineered thing, the eye. In this case, the human eye, but there are other forms of eye as well, which are, in their own way, are very complex. And of course, the eye is fine, but it's got to have a connection to the brain, and the brain's got to know how to interpret it. You know, it's not just a case of a bit of the skin that can detect light. It's got to be much more complex than that. So what about intelligent design? There's a book and a DVD. I recommend both of those if you've not read them or seen it. That's a very interesting DVD, which it really kind of comes out of this book, and that was the original book, Darwin's Black Box. There's other books that have been written since, which are quite interesting as well on this. I've just read one called Cell's Design, which is a very fascinating book, which goes on from Darwin's Black Box. And what we're going to look at now is really something, excuse me, that a little bit of something that comes out of Darwin's Black Box, although there's more in that book than just this. So, what is intelligent design theory? Well, I had a few pictures of those, so I thought I'd put them on. They're quite nice. Intelligent design is the assertion that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, not an undirected process such as natural selection. And that's what intelligent design is there as a theory to show. And in a way, to me, it's kind of a way of making a science out of common sense, because, you know, those evolutionists before said, well, you look at the world and it looks designed. Well, they're saying, well, it is designed, is what they're saying. But to convince somebody who believes in evolution, you have to have a process to make the point. And that's what this is about, really. So, intelligent design. I put a mousetrap because that's one of the examples that's used for something called irreducible complexity. There's two parts, if you like. There's more than this, but these are the two main parts two basic arguments of intelligent design. One is specified complexity, which is really common sense when you get down to it. Hopefully we'll see that. And the other one is irreducible complexity. And that basically means, like that mousetrap, if you've got the bits, it doesn't work. If you put them in the wrong order, it doesn't work. You've got to, there's basically five bits to a mousetrap. You've got to have all those bits together in the right place working. It either works or it doesn't. And that's the point, really, of irreducible complexity. So you look at life and you see, well, there's all these other things that are, and there's thousands upon thousands of things right in the complexity of the cell that are irreducibly complex. They either work or they don't, and there's no way they could slowly evolve into what they are. They have to be there as they are from the beginning, and that's the point of it. So specified complexity, and you'll see why I put that up in a minute, hopefully, that picture. Intelligence leaves behind a characteristic trademark or signature, is what it's saying. And there's practical applications, not just, you know, this application, but creation. Things like archaeology, you look at the ground, you dig out into the ground and find certain things, and you don't go, stone. You know, that's some things you find in pottery, and you look at them, and they don't look much more than a stone to me. And sometimes, you know, I've seen things on TV programs where they're doing archaeology, and they'll take it out and say, oh, it's got percussion marks on it, which means somebody's hit it, and it's a piece of flint. I look at it, it looks like a rock to me. But it's intelligence leads, somebody's done something, and you can tell by the way it's, the shape, the way it's marked or whatever, that it is something that has been handled by an intelligent being, if you like. and archaeology does that, and sometimes think, wow, how do they know that? Sometimes I suppose they don't really know, but they appear very clever, the archaeologists, in what they're doing sometimes. The things that, oh, they put things together, and I suppose there's a little bit of guesswork involved as well. Forensics is another idea, crime scene. You look at all the detail that's left behind on the crime scene and you piece together the evidence to find out what's gone on and who's been there. And the last one, SETI, is another one. It's probably quite futile, this, but anyway, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. You're looking for patterns, and we'll see an example that comes from a film, actually. But you're looking for patterns to tell you that something has come from intelligence rather than something's naturally occurring. The reason I put that there is you look at that and you assume somebody's put that sign there. You wouldn't look at that and think that just came all by itself. It's common sense, really, isn't it? And that's what specified complexity is. You look at it, yeah, somebody put that there, because those sort of things don't come about naturally. What's the process then of this specified complexity? It's common sense, really, but this is the process they give. And I struggle with this word contingent. It's a strange word, but it's what they want to use, the people who do this. So contingent just means when you look at something that you found, you don't know its origin, you look at it and you put it through this filter. And the first part of the filter is it contingent? And if it is, then it hasn't come from intelligence, or it fails this filter anyway. Sometimes it's not perfect, this, but it will throw away more things than it should, but it'll never catch something that hasn't been designed as if it has been designed. It's kind of overcompensates. But anyway, is it contingent? So contingency, something that's contingent or it's got a contingency, is something that's possible or could happen. Not that it will happen, but it could have happened, and it might occur naturally. And I suppose a good example of that might be an ice crystal, or if you go on the west coast of Ireland, you get those, are they octagonal rocks, the crystals, hexagonal rocks, isn't it, thank you, hexagonal rocks, yeah, octagonal don't fit together, do they, hexagonal rocks, and they look quite amazing, don't they, but they're volcanic in origin, and they formed because of the structure of the atoms underneath, so they would fail in this case. Is it complex? Well, a lot of things are complex, but simple things generally you can look at and think, well, it might not be designed that. But it's things that are complicated. Sometimes complicated things are designed, sometimes complicated things aren't designed, but it's another one on the list. So that's the next one. If it's complicated, then it passes. And the last one on the list, is it specified? So does it do something? Does it contain information? Does it perform a special task? Does it show a special pattern or something that makes us prick up our ears and go, ooh, you know, what is that? Who's done that? So it's just a list, really, that you follow to try and identify things. And it's trying to bring out what you do anyway in a common sense kind of a way. We'll look at some examples anyway. Here's the first example. Doesn't really mean anything to you or me, does it, that if you look at that? This is, I suppose, the example of words and of letters. The example's been given sometimes, well, if monkeys typed on a typewriter for long enough, you might get some words out of it, or, I don't know, Shakespeare, a sonnet or something like that, a poem or whatever. Well, it's actually been tried for about 5 months, and they didn't get this answer. That was me. I don't know how saying that is, but that was me. It's been tried for about 5 months with monkeys, and they did a lot of things to the typewriter, including typing on it. And the result actually was, after 5 months, there wasn't a single word in English, including A and I as a word, because you have to have a space either side. No words whatsoever. So just gives you an idea of how unlikely something like that is. So you would look at that and you say, well, it is complex, isn't it? There's lots of letters in there. I suppose it's contingent. It's, you know, just bashing on a keyboard, that would bring out that out. There's nothing clever about it. So it's failed on that front. And it's not specified. It doesn't mean anything, does it, when you look at it? However, that's a bit special, isn't it? And it's only a few letters. But if somebody sent you the top letter, you know, it'd be meaningless, wouldn't it? You just, well, what's that all about? Throw it away. You got the one below, you'd be quite pleased, I should think. It's a special letter. So it's just a sentence with three words in it. One of them's only one letter long that the monkeys couldn't even manage to do. But it's special, I love you, and it's what we all want to hear. So it gives you an idea, hopefully. As you said, we've got some other examples. There's another example. And it's the, I've forgotten what this place is called and I've not written it down. But anyway, this is another example. If you look at it in terms of, is it contingent? Could it happen naturally? Well, that could. At the side, the rocks, but this. You wouldn't expect the wind and the rain and so on to create something like that, would you? You know, it's obvious, really. But you go through the process. Is it complex? Well, that's complex, actually. And that's complex. So they both pass on the complex thing. Is it... I've forgotten what the last one is already. Is it specified? That's it. Well, that's not, is it? It's just erosion. It's meaningless. But in the middle there, yeah, that's definitely specified. That's three presidents of the United States. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln. I'll leave you to work out which is which. So you can see there the difference between them, and hopefully it's common sense, isn't it, really? Here's another example. I don't think I really need to go through the list again, but you look at that. Did that appear on the, you know, was it dropped off by a glacier on the last ice age, or did somebody build it? Well, I don't think anybody says it came off a glacier. Somebody built it, didn't they? But we don't know who. No idea. That's how archaeology looks at these things. You look at it and you go, well, somebody must have built that, but who? And we don't know. People try and work out what happened and who built it and how they built it, because we don't even know that. It's another example, isn't it? At Stonehenge, in this case, of something you look at and it leaves its footprint of intelligence behind its mark. Here's another one. I don't know if you can see this. Can you see it in the foreground, the circle? We went to the beach earlier in the year, and I walked past this and just took a quick picture of it because I'd noticed it as I went past. The other stones here, you can see, well, they're just stones, aren't they? But you walk past that and it catches your eye, because that doesn't happen naturally. Wind and waves and tide and people just kicking stones along don't create circles like that in the stones. Somebody sat down and maybe had a bored few hours and made a circle like that in the stones with a different coloured stones. And put some others in the middle. Again, same sort of example. The final example comes from a film, and this is from the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and the film is called Contact. This is the example. This is what in the film was, and in the book, the original book was found, was the thing that, the signal, if you like, that... And it was a sequence of beeps that started and stopped that made them think they'd been contacted by aliens. Anybody know what they are?
Prime numbers.
Prime numbers, yeah, that's right. I got one wrong before, so I had to, fortunately Jake spotted it and I had to put it right. But we've got prime numbers, yeah. So, you see, it doesn't happen naturally, does it, that? If you get a signal of beeps, you might expect beeps in a certain pattern maybe for certain reasons. And certainly that was one of the false signals that we got with quasars. Quasars are very fast spinning neutron stars, and you get a radio signal and it pips all the time over a certain period. Some are faster than others depending on how fast it's spun up. And initially that was sort of an alien signal, but it wasn't. It's a natural signal. But to get prime numbers transmitted and then repeated, that's something just a little bit different, isn't it? So again, it's the same sort of idea. The point is, these are all human examples, really, aren't they? But you can apply the same process when you look at life. Life is full of examples, particularly things like DNA, which is full of information. Where's that information come from? in the same sorts of way. You've got to put these things together, and you realise, using the same process and looking at life, life is full of all these sorts of examples. Irreducible complexity is the next one I want to look at, and that's in some ways a little bit easier to understand. I don't know. And this is the definition: a system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. So you can try this if you want. If you've got a petrol car and just pull off the lead from the spark plug and your car won't start, that's a great example of an irreducibly complex system. It's all got to be put together to work. And if you start taking bits off, it doesn't work. And there's no route that you can gradually work up to it. Now, I've forgotten to bring it, but I had an electric motor that I put together from a kit one of our kids got for the birthday. I've not brought it with me. No, I'll bring it back and I can take a piece out and show you it doesn't work, but I forgot. But anyway, it's been made. Those are the bits. No good like that. Put it together from the instructions, build a kit, you get a motor, put the battery in and it works. But if you take the battery out, or you take one of the magnets out, or there's a coil missing, or whatever really, or it's just not slotted into this bit properly, it doesn't work. It's all got to be working together, and that's the point. But that's a human example, again, human engineering. But as we'll see in our example, engineering within biology is just like that. It's not an analogy, it's the same, and that's the point. That's why it becomes bang up to date, and why the design argument is such a great argument. And now to look at as evidence for God's creation. So here's an example, and we'll go through this, of irreducible complexity in action. And it's a motor, just like that electric motor. This is a motor, actually runs on acid, but it's a motor nonetheless. And it's within certain cells, particularly E. coli is one of them. And Salmonella, some of the nasties, propel themselves along using the bacterial flagellum. So we're going to look at that. And then we're going to look at proteins and their shapes to see how it's built together, the Lego, if you like, of this that builds it together. And we're just going to have a look at the instructions and how proteins are made. You don't have to understand it entirely. And it's not that complicated in one sense either, but it's probably a lot to take in one go. But, you know, we'll get the idea. So, first of all, to try and make it easier, just to show you what it is, this is a little... hopefully this will work. It's a little animation of it. It'll disappear off my screen, I think, and go up on that one, hopefully. Oh. It's on there and not up there. It's never done that before. Brilliant. Can you see that? It's not ideal, is it? It's never done that to me before. Can't really see it. Can you see that? Okay, right. So... it's nearly all gone now, but basically, I'll run it again. When it gets to the end. Oh, could do without this. No, it's not going to go, it's not going to play. Right, that's what I didn't need. Right, so let's go back. So you've got a picture of it there. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like the video is going to go. It's going to go on the wrong screen, and I don't know why it's doing that to me. Never had that before. So we've got the motor there. So essentially, you've got a motor built up, and it's made up of three parts. There's a rotor, the bit in the middle that spins round, like in an ordinary motor. There's a stator on the outside, the bit that stays still. And there's a paddle, which is like a long thing in this case, rather than like the propeller on a motor. And it's made up of many component parts. There are actually 30 different proteins that make it up. And the proteins are all these little bits here. See the little shapes with there, all different proteins that are folded into very special shapes that build the whole thing, and of course it's self-assembled as well. If any of the parts are removed, then the whole thing stops to function. If you take any of these bits, obviously on the large scale, if you take the rotor out or you take the stator out, it won't work. But the detail of it as well, if any of those bits come out, it stops working. It either works or it doesn't, and that's quite an important point. So the problem then comes, if you believe in evolution, you've got a serious problem, because it either works or it doesn't. It's either there or it isn't. You can't evolve in one huge step to make that motor. If you believe in evolution that came from nothing to life, and in small steps created everything that we see, this is a huge hurdle to jump for evolution. And this is just one example of many thousands upon thousands of the parts of life that have this same property of irreducible complexity. So it has to be built as it is, or it won't work. There's no advantage to kind of a tail that drags along and slows the cell down and doesn't push it along, for example. So, how to build this flagellum? How is it built? Well, first of all, close to my heart, it's built on engineering principles, for starters. And it's the biological equivalent to an electric motor. It's no different, and it rotates, and it can rotate the other way. It's actually got a clutch on it as well, which is quite amazing as well, when you start to kind of look deeper into it as more detail is found. This is incredible. It self-assembles. You show me a motor that can self-assemble itself, and, well, I'll show you life, because it doesn't happen. Nothing man-made does that. It self-assembles, and you would have seen a video of that, but I think it's going to show on there instead of on there, so we're not going to get that. The building blocks, like I said, there's about 30 different types of proteins. The blueprint for the proteins and their assembly are coded into DNA. So there's a blueprint that tells the cell how to build those proteins and then what to do with those proteins to build that flagellum. Here's an example of DNA to just give you an idea of where that information comes from. DNA is made up of really a string of sugar polymers that go on the outside in a double helix, and it holds the information here in between, and these are called base pairs, and it's always, there's a C and a G and a T and an A, and it represents different molecules that bind together. There could be up to about 16 different possible molecules that could go in there, but these are the most efficient and the best ones by a long way, which again is interesting, that everything that you see in life appears to be optimized, and DNA is no exception. And so there's these base pairs, and they effectively hold information. And the information is twice as dense as the information on a computer, which uses binary. There's up to four options with each base pair on DNA, whereas in binary you've got two options on a computer. So it's more advanced than computing in that sense. There's an example just of E. coli again, which codes for that flagellum. There are 4.6 roughly million base pairs, 4.6 million of these within the DNA of E. coli, that one cell. There's a lot more in our cells, an awful lot more. I think it's 3 billion base pairs in our cells. They code for 4,289 proteins that the cell uses, and they're like the building blocks, the Lego, if you like, that builds the cell and allows the cell to function. There's other things coded for as well, but those are the most obvious things. Like I said, proteins are specific in shape or function, and they're used to build and to maintain the cell. DNA, and this is quite important as well, DNA has to be synthesized, copied, and then passed on to the next generation of cells as well. In each new generation of cell, DNA has to be passed on, so it has to be copied, split, copied, and passed on to the daughter cells of the next generation. Here's an example of how it puts together, if you like, how it codes for the proteins. Each of these are known as amino acids, and there's 20 amino acids in most life, actually. There's 20 amino acids that build together these proteins, and those proteins are built in long strings. And in DNA, these are the different molecules again. In this case, I've used U instead of T, because it's, we'll see in it, it's RNA and DNA, but basically T and U is the same thing. And the combination of three of those base pairs represents a particular molecule. So even not understanding that and looking at it, you can see the complexity of DNA, and in one sense the simplicity of it as well, of the design, in the sense that there's code words all the way along DNA. Three together, you've got to have three to code at least three, which will code for 64 actually, different combinations, but there's 20 amino acids that are used to build up proteins together. And so each of these words represents a particular amino acid, and it uses that information to build the proteins by putting them together in the order that the DNA tells it to put it together. And there's also, if you look here, there's a stop and a start, so it tells it where to stop and where to start to build these proteins as well. So it almost looks man-made, really, in the way it's built, but obviously it's God-made and it's more complex. Now, some of them, there's more than one option, and that reduces the likelihood of error in the way that it's done. They're not random. If you look, they're not random. They put in specific blocks, and it reduces the possibility of errors in building up the proteins within the body, which is very important as well. I've got a horrible feeling this one's not going to show either, because I'm going to turn this around before I even start. I think I know what's happening here. I'm going to do an experiment that I wish I hadn't done in a minute. Right. Yes, it worked. Right, so this is just a little video, if you like, that just gives you an idea of what's going on inside the cell. It's not too easy to see in this light, is it? But that stopped. Mm-hmm. We're doing well, aren't we? Right, back again. Start again. So this is a view within the cell, and it's going into the nucleus. It's going to go like this one, is it? One of these pores in the nucleus. And these are like gateways into the nucleus of the cell. And you go in and you look inside and you'll see this is the DNA within the cell. And what's going to happen now in a minute as it goes through, it's going to start... We'll see there's a molecular machine, if you like, and it starts to cut and open up the DNA at the specific point that it wants to do a copy of what's on the DNA in order to make a protein. So this is what it's doing. So this is just a representation of that. So these are molecular machines. These are made of proteins as well. And another protein machine, molecular machine, comes here, and it starts to build a copy, like a photocopy, if you like. And that is built in something that's called messenger RNA, which is just a description of the molecule that's built. And that copies that information to take outside the nucleus of the cell and then go and build the proteins from that, which are used to build the parts of the cell. So this is a gatekeeper that only lets in and out the things that matter. It won't let in and out things that shouldn't be going in and out of the cell, of the nucleus of the cell. So it comes out of the cell, and then it goes into what's called a ribosome. And a ribosome is the place where the transcription, the copying of that information that's on the RNA that was copied off the DNA, is then created. And it uses the messenger RNA and the transfer RNA here, which I think is called anticodons, because they're the opposite of what's up here. And on the bottom here, these are the amino acids that are coded for. You see there's three base pairs, three of them to make a codon, represents one amino acid. The chain of amino acids is creating the protein. You just think of protein as something we eat, don't we, boys? Actually, this is what's
what's being built up. So it builds up that long chain of protein. And then that chain of protein is then taken into another molecular machine which takes it in and folds it into the specific shape that's needed to make whatever the cell needs to make. And so it's folded up, as the animation shows there, and into a specific shape. And some of it is just the way it's built, it folds automatically, but some of it has to be helped in that folding process as well. And that's what the what DNA is there, and that's how the proteins in your body are made. And then that that now folded protein, which is for a specific purpose, is then shepherded to the right place within the shell, within the cell, and taken to wherever it needs to be to do the job that it's supposed to do. So you can see, not only is it complex, it's very clever, isn't it? To me, well, if there was a spaceship that could do that kind of thing to look after itself, you wouldn't think it happened by accident, would you? It's just ridiculous. It is to my mind, anyway. Alright, so go on to the next stage. This is the building. This is what you do with those proteins that you've made then. In this case, the flagellum is just an animation showing how and what order the flagellum is built together. And obviously not quite like this, but it gives you the feel for how it's built. And it's built in this order within the cell. So this is kind of the membrane, the inner and outer membranes of the cell. And it's building it up. And this is quite interesting. This little protein, I don't know what you call it, really, like a five-legged stool. And it... There's three different ones of these that build the flagellum, the bit that the propeller part that flags it along. This is like a universal joint that's being built. So it uses this to build a universal joint, and it's hollow in the middle. So I'll build another one now. You sort of see them come through in here in a minute when it shows it. So here they come through the middle. Build this last five-leg stool, and this is there just to guide out the other pieces into the right shape as it builds that flagellum along it. And this is just a cell that makes you ill. Salmonella or E. coli, that kind of cell. And it's something we think nothing of in many ways. But it's an incredible design. And it's just one example of design within a cell. The cell's full of this. And our cells are full of this kind of design. It's spectacular. And the more you look, the more amazing it is. And so, as you can see, as it's going through, it's building that that flagellum, that propeller that runs off the motor. And just let it run to the end of that and finish the animation just to show what it's doing. So, I just want to summarise really through that, because obviously there's a lot of information there. So you get, first of all, you start off with the DNA, and it's and it's only stable within the nucleus of the cell, but it's there and it's kept there. The DNA is copied, it's opened up, copied onto RNA. The RNA then is allowed out of the cell wall because it's information, out of the nucleus through the gatekeeper holes to be made, to go for transcription within the ribosome. So the messenger RNA comes in, you get transfer RNA, which holds amino acids, which build up a protein from that information. It takes about a minute, I think, from what I remember from things that I've read. It takes about a minute to build that protein, depending on the protein, sometimes quicker. The protein is then folded into the correct shape to be used within the cell. And then it's shepherded to where it's needed. After that, the proteins are put together to build up whatever it is, in this case a bacterial flagellum. And the end product is that motor with all its parts together that started off as a blueprint and is built to do its job within the cell. Just before we go any further, just some thoughts, some facts about DNA. I think this is quite an important thing to think about. The minimum complexity for independent life appears to be
about 1,350 genes, which is only a guesstimate at this because genes are different lengths, but about 1.3 million base pairs. So for independent life to exist, you've got to have all that at once within a cell. That's simple cells. That's very complex, actually, isn't it, when you think about it? So it's a big problem for somebody who is an atheist. How did life begin when that's the simplest you get as independent life? You can't include things like viruses, which are smaller genomes, but they're parasitic. Without other life, they can't exist. That's the simplest life that can exist, sort of that kind of gene size, that kind of length of DNA. Anything smaller than that is incapable of living on its own. Works, it obviously points to creation and a creator. This is quite important. DNA codes for proteins, but proteins make DNA. The protein machines that DNA code for make DNA. So it's a chicken and egg, isn't it, if you think about it? Which came first? The chicken and the egg. Which came first, DNA or protein? Well, you can't have one without the other. It's a simple answer. Again, it's something that tells us that there had to be something to start it in the beginning that was intelligent. It had to be God at the beginning that started things off. The genetic code is universal, and it's optimized as well. It's the best code we could have, but it's universal. And that's not something that evolution would really predict, because evolution tells us that different routes, via different routes, different things would have evolved into what they are. And you would expect the genetic code, which also must have evolved if evolution is true, not to be the same everywhere, to be different. Not those codons that code for certain amino acids are the same in everything. I think that points to one God. I don't think it can point to anything else. It tells us that there is only one God who created everything by looking at the genetic code, because it's universal. There's a universal God. There are thousands of examples of evolutionary convergence, which means when evolutionists have this tree of life and they see that some things go off that way and some things go off that way, and these aren't related apart from way down here, and you look at something like the eye or the bacterial flagellum that we saw, there are, for the flagellum, there's at least two different routes that are known that they could have occurred through that evolutionary tree. So they've evolved twice, exactly the same, with the same code, in exactly the same way, but completely independently. For a random thing, that's unbelievably unlikely. In the terms of the eye, that's 40 times. Even more unlikely to have happened. And convergence is something that wasn't expected by the evolutionists, but is actually, there are thousands of examples of it now. And it argues against evolution and for God, for a God who's used the same code, the same process, to create the same thing in different living creatures. Again, it's much more obvious that there is a God who's created those things and designed them than it is that there is, these things came about by pure blind chance. So, putting it all together, is it fair to conclude that the appearance of the design in nature is nothing but an illusion? And I think it's not. I don't think that's fair at all. I've just given you some examples there. That's the tip of the iceberg that we've seen tonight. Does the information contained in the DNA store not suggest an intelligent designer? All that information that had to be there in such a large size, even in the simplest cell to begin with, surely that tells us there's information there, and that information tells us that somebody is behind the design of that DNA, because it's information that codes for something. If we saw that in anything else that wasn't life, we'd assume somebody had designed it. It's obvious. If DNA, the cell function, and it's a bit of a mouthful, but bio-nano-engineering are irreducibly complex, in other words, they have to work all together, all as a piece that all works interlocking with each other, or if you take a piece out, it fails. Then how do they come to exist in the first place? If it's all got to be together to work, or it doesn't work, it's not evolved. It has to have been engineered, designed, made, created. And of course, to me, the simplest explanation is probably near to where we started, isn't it? The simplest explanation for the appearance of design is design. It seems obvious to me, and that's the obvious. You're almost not seeing the elephant in the room, aren't you, when you say, oh, it appears to be designed, but it isn't. Well, it is. It's designed. That's the obvious answer, and I think it's the fair answer. So let's go back to the Bible and just have a... just look at a few more verses from Psalms and from a couple of places, and from Isaiah and from Romans. Psalms, first of all, we already looked at this at the beginning. This is another verse from it, where it just says, "My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they all were written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there was none of them." And I suppose I want to kind of think about that as well in the scroll. I don't know whether it's really referring to DNA, but the principle is there, isn't it, in that scroll of information within us all that's passed on. The principle is there, that information is passed on and we're built from that information. God built us, and he built us from a store of information in his book, if you like, and that's represented in the DNA that we see in every one of our cells that builds us from the beginning. Well, why did God create us then? To me, it's pretty obvious that God created us. So why did he? Well, thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who established it. He did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is no other. So, one God, which is fairly obvious from the things that we have seen in nature, things like the Universal Code and so on, demand that there is one God, and that one God created us for a purpose. It's not blind, it's not purposeless, there's a purpose to the world, and that's the kingdom of God, and that's to serve God, and to live forever in that kingdom on earth. He did not create it in vain. We formed it to be inhabited, and we've got to make a choice. Do we want to follow that way or do we not? The last one I want to look at, and I hopefully can you look this up, please? We've not really looked anything else up. Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. We thought about this at the beginning. Romans chapter 8, chapter 1 and verse 18. "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness, in the lusts of their hearts, to dishonour their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever." So, there is making the strong point, isn't he, that even within ourselves, it's obvious that we are created. God's invisible attributes are clearly seen by the things which are made. And people who profess to be wise become fools because of that. And we can see that in some of the statements in the world around us. But really, we are without excuse. We shouldn't serve the creature. which is what evolution does. I know this is maybe talking in the context of the verses at this time, maybe about idol worship, but evolution really isn't much different to that. It worships the creature rather than the creator. It marvels at nature, but not at God. And they exchange the truth of God for a lie in the things that we see. And I think that's a fair assessment of the world that we live in. And different ages have different ways of doing this, but our age does it through atheism and the theory of evolution. So we've seen the evidence. We have a lifespan to have. What are we going to believe? What are we going to follow? Are we going to go with atheism, there's no God, or are we going to go with the things of God? Which means we have to do something about it. I'm not going to read all that, but the first line, seek the Lord while he may be found. That's the point, isn't it? My ways are not your ways, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my thoughts higher than your ways. So are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. God knows much better than us. He's given us a way. We've got a choice. We've got a Bible we can read and understand his way, and we can follow it, or we can just go on and ignore it and not bother with it and go the other way and pretend that God isn't there. But the reality is that he is. So we've got a choice. And it's a stark choice, isn't it, really? That's one choice. The choice of evolution, which gives us, well, and atheism in particular, which means that we can be selfish. We live by the rules of survival of the fittest, and that's created a lot of problems in this world, both politically and individually. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, which is not quite a biblical quote, but almost. And the for tomorrow we die, I don't think is biblical, but the other part is. But the point is there, isn't it, that, excuse me, that we have a limited lifespan. And if we think there's nothing else, then we are without hope in the world. We've got nothing else. And it's a bit dismal, really. The alternative is the new dawn that comes in the kingdom of God, which gives us hope. We have hope for the future. There's a description of eternal peace. A new creation, so that we're not dying creatures anymore through the gift of God, through the grace of God, if we are taken into the kingdom of God because we follow his ways and the examples that are given in the Bible. There's a new creation of everlasting life where God will wipe away all tears. And I want to leave you really with that challenge that comes from Deuteronomy. He says, God says, I set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Choose life.